Hi folks, Ben Stone here from the Bad Quaker Show. Today we're going to play an interview that I did with Mike Shanklin over at Voluntary Virtues. And you can find the original of this, which is a YouTube video, if you just go to badquaker.com in today's show notes, and you'll see the actual YouTube video is right there on badquaker.com's page. And if you'd like, you can click on that video and go over to YouTube and subscribe to Michael Shanklin's YouTube channel. He's got a lot of good stuff over there. And you can also follow the link in today's show notes over to Voluntary Virtues and see what other kind of projects that Mike is working on. So without any further, here is my interview over on Michael Shanklin's show at Voluntary Virtues.
Hey everyone, welcome to Triple V, a show dedicated towards advancing the message of a free society. I'm your host, Mike Shanklin. Today I'm joined by a real special guest. His name's Ben Stone. Ben Stone's daily podcast can actually be found at badquaker.com. I'll include that in the description section below, where liberty is the mission. Badquaker.com is a website dedicated towards exploring the zero aggression principle and its impact on individuals. It's always good to have been on any show. I know he was on Adam Kokesh's Adam vs. the Man with me the other day. Actually, he was on the night before I was, but he's been getting in around quite a bit, and I'm finally having him on my show for the very first time. How are you doing today, Ben?
Pretty good. It's good to talk to you again, Mike.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And
go ahead.
And good to see you.
Yeah.
Last time we talked, it wasn't video.
Yeah, well, actually, I have a question from a viewer. I didn't bring this up when we were talking earlier, talking about maybe you moving to video vodcasts or some. I don't know what she was wanting to do, but, you know, people like to hear video or see video just as much as they do podcasts. But anyway, let's move on with the show. It's good to have you on the show. I always ask every single person who comes on my show how they got to their philosophy, you know, and maybe how, if they could explain non-aggression or the zero aggression axiom. I know that's what you call it, and I love that term. But how did you get to this position? And, you know, were you homeschooled, private schooled, public schooled? Were your parents political, apolitical?
I was public school my whole life, but with an odd twist. In the I was advanced part of a year and was just gone completely part of a year. So that's you could say it was like with kindergarten, it ended up being like 11 years of school, of public school. And if I recall, I changed schools 16 different times in that 11 years of education. So that alone gave me a certain level of skepticism as I moved from school to school. It really wasn't that hard to see that the whole thing was a scam. And some of the teachers I had, you know, even as a little kid, I would just be amazed at how ignorant they were. And I use that word, not dumb, not, you know, stupid, but ignorant, just having no knowledge of basic things. So I think that was a good start for me of not having the proper state education. And then in addition to that, I had a super advantage in the fact that my dad was a very rebellious person by nature. He was a self-taught, unlicensed airplane pilot. Now, just kind of roll that around in your head for a second. Self-taught, unlicensed airplane pilot. Probably owned, over the course of years, he probably owned a dozen different planes. He was an inventor, a tinkerer. He couldn't stay in one place more than a couple of years, and he'd have to move, and couldn't work for the same people for more than a couple of years. And this gave me a sort of an outlook not to be dependent on systems that were, you know, provided for me. And I think it put in my brain just that level of rebellion to say, you know, if you don't need a license to fly a plane, you just get in it and fly and don't ask permission. What do you need a license to, you know, carry a gun, to drive a car, to build your own house on your own property? Why do you need a license to build your own house on your own property? You know, and these things, and my dad also owned a construction company on and off for several years. And we would constantly, I'm like 12, 13, 14 years old, and running into these inspectors that are coming out, and, you know, they have no idea what we're doing in construction. They don't have the slightest clue how the industry runs, and yet they've got this job where they have the yes or no on whether or not we're going to continue and finish a multi-million dollar job. You know, it just, as a 13-year-old kid, I'm like, this makes no sense whatsoever. Who are these people? You know? Mm-hmm. And my first, by the time I was in my late teens, I was really even rebelling against my own family. I was running my own, how do we say it politely, black market substance business and running sort of a collections racket on the side for some motorcycle enthusiasts. Can we say it like that?
Yeah.
So that was my first taste in economics, and then my first taste in politics was during the Jimmy Carter years in the late 70s. I was involved with NORML, National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and so I was going door to door trying to get people to sign petitions to get the government to allow, you know, to give the permission so that people could own a plant, and after a lot of effort. Well, that went on. I was only with NORML for about a year and a half, but I continued trying to be involved in politics through the Reagan, so-called Reagan Revolution. And I was dumb enough, well, I shouldn't say it like that, I was naive enough that I believed when Ronald Reagan would talk, you know, because he spoke very libertarian. He would say things like, government's the problem, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that's right. But it wouldn't connect me that this guy's the problem. He's the one that's talking it. He's the one that's doing it. It doesn't matter the words that are coming out of his mouth. Look at his actions and his deeds. That didn't dawn on me. So for 8 years, I was entirely fooled. And then at the end of that, I still had these libertarian ideas, you know, but I wasn't really founded in the zero aggression principle. And we would argue, like my other libertarian friends, we'd argue about whether stop signs were a good idea. That was the depth of our, you know, about as far as we really thought things through. And then in 88, when Ron Paul first ran for president, I thought, you know, I tore up my Republican membership card. I literally tore it up and mailed it into him. And I thought, this is it. This is the answer. Right here you go. And unfortunately, in 88, the Libertarian Party they had a real gem in their candidate, in Ron Paul. He was still young. He was very vibrant. He was enthusiastic. He's intelligent. I mean, all the good things you can say about Ron Paul were more so in 1988. And they put him on things like afternoon talk shows where the whole plot of the show is for people to yell at each other. And he didn't fit in this at all. And they gave him, like, you know, the support that the Libertarian Party gave him in 88 really upset me. And so by the time the election was over, I'd given up on politics, which was a good thing. We should all give up on politics, right? You know. And but I had a young family to raise, and I literally just put my head down and started making money and trying to make a living, trying to raise my family, you know, try to keep them out of public school as much as possible. We did, you know, this is back before the terminology was really even popular, but we did unschooling, we did homeschooling, we traveled around the country for months at a time and living in a pickup truck and just not, you know, totally off the grid, letting the kids camp out where wild horses were roaming around our camp. You know, it was just a blast, and gave them the experiences that hopefully, or, you know, this was kind of what I wanted, was for my kids to not be cookie cutter children, you know, just mindlessly following what the state told them to do. By 98 or so, I had to fly on an airplane because there was a legal situation in Nevada that I had to fly there and deal with the legal situation and fly back to Ohio. And I decided after that experience, and we're talking pre-9/11, so this is pre all the nonsense with the TSA and stuff. And I went through the security to get on the plane in Ohio to fly to Nevada. And it angered me so bad. They, you know, their whole, even then, the whole idea that I'm guilty of something just because I walked up and wanted to fly on a plane. And so I waved it off, and I had to do it then. I took care of it, flew out there, came back, and I decided, that's it. I'm not flying ever again. And then after 9/11 happened, and the government really turned tyrannical in a way that I don't know how anybody can deny it, I was kind of left with nothing to do but fight it. And my children were raised, and they were out of the house, so I thought, okay, I have to go for this 100%. I have to clarify what I think, what I believe, and just go into it with everything I've got. And by that time, my oldest daughter was a full-blown anarchist. I mean, she was no-holds-barred anarchist. And I was still kind of hoping, well, you know, maybe Ron Paul can come back and maybe we can lighten some of the gun laws and maybe we can, you know, just make life a little bit easier for a generation to come. But my daughter really drew the line, and she said, well, do you believe this? And I'd say, well, sure, I believe that, but we have to approach these things carefully. We have to compromise sometimes. Why do you have to compromise? Well, because this is how politics works. Yeah. But is compromise good? And we would just bat these things back and forth for hours sometimes. And by the time we started the podcast in, I believe it was in 2011 when we started the podcast, I was left with no logical position to hold that politics was anything, and any use of politics was anything other than masked aggression. You know, I had read Rothbard, I had read Mises, I had read all the right stuff, you know, even going into, you know, Stefan Molyneux stuff when he started into the 2000s when he started producing. I'd read all that stuff and I would follow it all up on it, but it didn't really come together in my mind and say, absolutely, voting is aggression. Being involved in government in any way, to use the hand of government in any way, is aggression. And if it's okay for me to use the government for what I want it to do, then it's okay for somebody else to use the government against me for what they want. But if it's not okay for them to use it against me, it's not okay for me to use it against them. And so that, you know, that was the sort of the progression. I don't know if you needed that much information or not, but that was the progression to the point of where I really looked at myself and I said, I can't compromise on these things. I'm not perfect. I'm always going to mess up and aggress on this or that point. But it has to be, zero aggression has to be the point at which I'm firing at. If I'm firing over there near zero aggression, then I might as well just do what I want to do and forget about it. Because the robber who robs the bank justifies robbing the bank with the same series of logic that the politician uses to collect taxes. So either you're in this thing 100% and you're firing towards the target and you're aiming towards the target, or you're not. And if you're not, then you know they're you're not going to achieve what you're shooting at or what you're hoping for. And if you apply certain things like the zero aggression principle, if you try to apply them to some things but not other things, then all you're really doing is lying to yourself. You don't really have a principle. You've abandoned the principle. Because the principle means you have to stick with it all the time, whether you like it or not.
No, I completely agree with you, Ben. That was really good. I'm glad you told that story on my show. You know, maybe we could take this to the next step. And you knew it was a question I was going to ask you anyway. We might as well get it out of the way. And maybe we could touch on Rand for a second too. But do you think that Ron Paul is good or bad for the message of freedom? I mean, obviously, we just had Rand Paul do a 13-hour filibuster to bring up attention for the drone strike program, which obviously on that one thing, I think it did good. But, you know, like, what's your thoughts on Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and fighting inside the system, Libertarian Party? And, I mean, obviously, you don't see it as the answer, but is it necessarily bad? Is it bad? What's your thoughts?
Well,
take a drink.
I have to be. Yeah. I have to be honest, and I haven't always held this position. I'm evolving to this position, and I don't really even necessarily like this position. I don't like saying these things, but let's see what I can compare it to. You know, if you've I'll just say it straight out. Okay, let's assume in 2008. you heard the Ron Paul message, and you're like, hey, this sounds pretty good. Well, there was something that caused you to stop and listen to the Ron Paul message. What he was saying in 2008 was so far out of the mainstream that if you're just watching Fox News and you're watching CNN and you're just doing the normal thing every day, you would never hear him. I mean, he would really never sink into you. I'll use my brother, for example. You know, my brother in 2008 was watching the news every day. He was keeping up on all the current events. He knew what all the politicians were saying. He knew what every single Republican running for the president stood for, except Ron Paul. And he had no clue what Ron Paul stood for because he didn't want to know. He already had the message he liked within the acceptable Republicans that were running. So Ron Paul could have said anything. He could have wore Mickey Mouse ears, or better yet, he could have wore a rubber boot upside down on his head and talked about dental health. And my brother wouldn't have known what he was doing. He wouldn't have known that because it wasn't within it wasn't what he was looking for. And this is going to sound like it's detached, but I'll try to bring it together. Herbert Spencer, back in the 1800s, faced a thing that was called the great man theory. And the great man theory essentially was, a guy like Napoleon is a once in a generation type person. And when a person like that appears, he's almost, it's according to whether you believe, you know, in like a creation or evolution or a guided history or whatever. But the idea was that this Napoleon, this great man, has been given to us by God, or he's an anomaly of history, and he's an advanced freak of evolution to take us into the next thing. It's according to how you look at this philosophy, but it's still the same thing. It's this guy who's magically unusual and totally different from everybody else in society. And so surely he must be our leader. Well, Herbert Spencer said, no, that's nonsense. It's just absolutely nonsense. There's a market for something. There's a market for a leader. There's a market for a butcher. There's a market for a guy who, you know, fixes windows. And someone will step into that market. Now, that guy might be pretty good at it, or he might be pretty bad at it. But there's nothing magical about leadership that God or evolution or the system or the state, there's nothing magical about that that brings about this holy man that can come and solve all our problems by telling us how to live. Well, a lot of people look at Ron Paul that way. Ron Paul is, nobody's done as much for the liberty movement as Ron Paul. You can say that in any circle, and almost everybody will nod their head. But when they do that, they're actually stepping outside of proper Austrian economics. Because when you have a supply and demand issue, there has to be a demand for something in order to have a successful market. If nobody wants iPhones, if nobody's, you know, if you could just drop into 1620 with a big bucket of iPhones, you couldn't sell them. They would be useless. Nobody could conceive in their mind what they were good for. Even if you had all the cell towers in place and everything, you would have a product that nobody wanted. Nobody had a need for it. Okay, so if we have this magical Ron Paul, which is such a great man, given to us by God or by whatever purposes that you believe in, you have this wonderful thing. If there's not a market for it, nobody cares, like in 1988. Nobody cared. The message was the same in 1988. But in 2008, all of a sudden, people were looking for something. They wanted to hear that right words. And Ron Paul, among 50 other people, were prominent in saying it. Ron Paul happened to have a platform that he could talk on. But much of his message was horribly flawed. So now, to take back what I was starting to say earlier, let's say, no, let me finish that thought. So what created, remember the supply and demand balance here. It doesn't matter what supply you have. If there's not a demand for it, you can't sell your product. So what created the demand in 2008 for Ron Paul? And the answer would be the oppression that took place between 2000 and 2008. The advances, well, not even that. If you go back into Clinton years, let's go all the way back to 1988. From 88 until 2008, during that whole 20-year reign, You know, Waco took place, Ruby Ridge took place. The most of the horrible Homeland Security nonsense was written during the Clinton years, and what they weren't able to implement it until after 9/11.
500,000 children dead in Iraq because of sanctions and war.
Exactly, and the American people pretty much totally comfortable in Clinton just randomly sending drone strikes. Clinton was doing that stuff, not drone strikes, but he was doing what do they call it? Cruise missile strikes. Which, I mean, if you're blown to pieces, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really matter what the, you know, what the platform was. But he was doing that all the way through his administration, and nobody really, I shouldn't say nobody, most people didn't take notice. But these things collected together to the point of in 2008, a lot of us said, I don't want to be molested by TSA agents. I don't want to have to be stopped and have dogs sniff my car and you know, rip the stuff out of my car because a dog gives a false signal on my car just because they want to take my car. I mean, that's really what it's about. The confiscation laws now, they just, you know, if they find a dirty $1 bill in your car, there it is. You're using it for drug trafficking. We own your car now. So these things built up over time, over those 20 years, and created a market for Ron Paul. And in 2008, if you, let's say in 2008, you gave the maximum amount that you could give to the Ron Paul campaign, well, good for you. I'm glad that you caught the message. I'm glad that you heard it and everything like that. But think about this. What if in 2008, instead of giving that same amount of money to Ron Paul, you had started a business or you had done something else to promote the liberty. I hate to use the word,
movement.
The liberty movement. Yeah, because it sounds like it's something temporary and it's emotion based. So all of us on the team over here at BadQuaker.com have started saying the liberty mission, because a mission means you have a plan. And you have a destination, and you want to accomplish a specific thing. So it's not just like, hey, we're all getting together for a party. It's not like a trendy thing. It's like, we know where we're going, we know what we want, and we know how to get there. And so in 2008, instead of giving money to somebody who's going to take that money and spend it within the political process to try to change the very nature of the monster that oppresses us, government, if you had taken that same amount of money, think of it as an investment, and invested in Michael Shanklin and his videos, or, you know, any of a number of things, the Mises Institute, or any number of things that were happening in 2008 that were right on the cutting edge, the Free State Project, there's any number of these different things that were happening that were actually on target in 2008. And they didn't have the message that what we need to do is use the government to fix the government. Because essentially, that's the Ron Paul message. Essentially, it's, yeah, I'm involved in government. Let's take the in the Fed argument. That's the big Ron Paul thing that almost anybody can immediately associate with Ron Paul, in the Fed. Okay, if you ask the government to end the Fed for you, what do you think they're going to do once they end the Fed? Are they just going to go, oh, well, I didn't realize that for 100 years a small group of people oppressed you and robbed you. We'll stop that, and now everything will be right as rain. You know, the government's not going to do that. If Congress were to end the Fed tomorrow, they would replace it with something that gave them more power and more ability to rob you. That's what Congress's answer would be. As a matter of fact, they're out there actively within the liberty movement. There are these people who are yelling in the Fed, and what they want to replace the Fed with is giving Congress the ability to do exactly what the Fed does, but give that power to Congress. They're called greenbackers. Well, what did you solve? You took the power away from the bankers and gave it to Congress because they're so responsible?
Even though the Congress gave it to the bankers in the first place.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, and I don't believe this kind of a conspiracy. I'm just making this up here, channeling Alex Jones. But it's almost like in 1930, 1912, when they're scheming all this, they're like, well, the American people would never sit by and let Congress take control of the money supply. So what do? We'll trick them. We'll create the Federal Reserve, and for 100 years, we'll abuse the money supply. And when the people finally catch on, then we'll give it to Congress. You know, it's almost like it's that easy of a conspiracy. Now, of course, I don't believe in conspiracy, so I don't think anything was ever that simple. But if we do exactly what Ron Paul planned in the Fed, have government in the Fed, well, I know when we all talk among ourselves, we say, well, competing currencies would fix this problem. You think government's going to allow a competing currency? They're going to voluntarily give away power? That's I could believe in the Easter Bunny easier than I could believe that the government is going to voluntarily give away the ability to centrally plan the most important aspect of the means of production, which is the money supply.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this all takes root in the propaganda center, if you want to call it that, public education. I was in both public and private school, and I saw a huge difference in both realms. But it seems to me that there's a lot of revisionist history. We could call it that, maybe, if some people obviously are a little sour to that word. But I think it's a pretty fair term. And when we're looking at – I can remember it, when I was in school, I actually had a book written by Ben Bernanke. So I was that pupil – who was in the middle and who was caught in that system. And I'll tell you right now, they tried to confuse more of the students than they really did try to educate them. It was like confuse them to the point where they just will do whatever, sit down and shut up, and they won't ask too many questions, and we can just move through this, and I'll make their exams so easy, so the ones who study can maybe get it, you know, and I'll put in the pretty basic definitions and stuff like that. So that's what, you know, that's what college seemed like to me, at least for those 3 years. And I did study well. I got dean's lists and presidential scholarship awards and a bunch of good stuff. So I really did work hard. But I saw what the public education system was doing to people. And it's not telling you the full truth, right? And obviously they can't even take it to the full rational conclusion. I mean, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, because you really know some history here. Maybe what's some of the biggest revisionist moments that you've seen in history? Or what do you call it? Historical skepticism, right? Is that what you call it?
Yeah. I need to go back and credit my dad and my mom on this to a certain extent, because, you know, from my youngest days, back in the 60s, they had a TV series on called Daniel Boone. And at first, it was all shot in black and white. You know, in the 60s, they a lot of the TV shows were in black and white. And the Daniel Boone show was supposedly set in Kentucky. Well, my mom and dad and all of my family are from Kentucky. And the Daniel Boone show was actually filmed in California, in the hills of on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. So even in black and white, if you've ever visited the western hills of California on the San Joaquin Valley, and if you've ever visited pretty much anywhere east of the Mississippi, you can't possibly confuse these two places. I mean, there's just absolutely no similarity, you know, other than the sky is up and the ground is down. That's about where the similarity ends. And so my dad would see this show, this Daniel Boone show on TV, and it would almost be uncomfortable being in the room with him, because he would pick this apart so badly. You know, no, that's not how history was. No, that's not how Kentucky looks. No, the Shawnees were not constantly the bad guys and the Cherokees constantly the good guys. This is cartoonish. This is worse than Batman. You know, Batman was a popular TV show back in the same time frame. And this gave me a certain skepticism, because I could go to school and the popularity of the TV show Daniel Boone was such that the teachers at school would practically teach history from that TV show, ignore the history book altogether. And they would just talk about the TV show like if that was the history lesson. And so I knew that there was something wrong in this. And my mother when she was young, she was of the age of where she supported Franklin Roosevelt back in the 30s and early 40s. And she believed everything that the government told her and everything the government had to say, and the, you know, like about the beginning of World War II and all these kind of things like this. And by the time she got into where she was more mature, by the time she got up into her 20s, she realized that everything that she had been told about the beginning of World War II was a lie. She started figuring this out by like 47, 48, 49, and 50. And just within the limited amount of, you know, there was no internet, there wasn't really even good books at the time on the topic, but with people that she knew, soldiers and sailors and Marines that were actually her age group, and people that she knew that were actually in Hawaii at the time, she knew the story was different. She knew that this hadn't taken place like it did, that there was more to it than they were being told. And so, you know, by the time that I was getting an age of where I would understand these things up into the 70s, she would tell me things like, I don't know how D-Day happened, but I know it didn't happen the way they're telling us. So by the time I was even, you know, 15 or 18 years old, I had already decided in my mind that, you know, talking about Napoleon earlier, I think it was Napoleon that said, history is written by the victor. And that means, you know, what he was attempting to point out was that, like in the case of Napoleon, when Napoleon was on top, when he was the great hero, when he was the great man saving Europe, you know, all the history was being written about him, that he literally was the next Alexander the Great. He was bringing, you know, to toss this phrase around, he was bringing liberty to the people of France. He was setting them free from oppression. But then, when he was out of power, then we find out that, no, that's not the case. He was a horrible oppressor. He destroyed the economy. He sent guys out to do busy work, digging ditches, and then filling the ditches back in so the soldiers would get paid. He would have soldiers digging ditches and then filling the ditches back in because he believed that would stimulate the economy. Well, you know, as time goes by, he was exposed for the tyrant and the idiot that he really was. And then as time goes, when he was in power, he was thought to be this great military genius. And then as years go by and people look at his strategies and they go, you take as many men as you can get and you run them directly into gunfire. That's not a brilliant statistician. So the whole method of Napoleonic warfare was stupid. It just kills off people. That's all it does. And so later on, you know, so now you've got two directly opposite histories about the same guy. And so who wins? What was the real truth? Well, the real truth was that Napoleon was an opportunist like everybody else. So if we take that same logic and we apply it to, let's say, 1941, to December 7th, 1941, and then we find out, well, you know, an order went out to bring all of the airplanes and huddle them together, not spread them out like you normally do on an airfield where they're hard to hit from the air. You lump them all together in one place. Now, why would you do that? Then you send out the order to unload all the anti-aircraft guns in the whole base and lock all of the ammunition in lock boxes and remove the keys from the normal people that control the keys to the lockboxes. Why would you do that? Why would you do that like 3 days before the actual attack took place? And then the word starts getting out, well, as it turns out, they were intercepted radio messages, and we had broke their code. And we knew to the day when I wasn't there. I'm pretty sure you weren't there.
Yeah.
But the U.S. knew to the day when this was going to take place. And You start seeing, oh, and the government, the U.S. government, had warned the Red Cross days beforehand. Are you prepared for a disaster? You should get this kind of equipment. You should look for this many casualties. It was a trade-off. They took the oldest ships in the fleet, shoved them into the worst bottleneck in the Pacific, which was this horrible Pearl Harbor. If you look at it in Google, Everybody coming in and out of Pearl Harbor has to go through this one little narrow bottleneck. And all you have to do is drop one good-sized boat in that bottleneck, and the whole thing's closed. Nobody can get out. It's a shooting match for the from the sky, and nobody can do a thing about it. Well, that was the strategy. But oddly enough, all 100% of the new ships were out at sea. Only the old ships were in Pearl Harbor. Wow, what a coincidence. Like series after series of coincidence. And this information was available to me as a high school student in the 70s. And I started putting this stuff together, and I started realizing, you know, it's all lies. Everything the government gives you, you should assume it's a lie first, and then try to see what really happened. So I'd start going back. You know, there's been wonderful work done by different writers about the so-called Civil War and the lie that it was about slavery and what it was really about, a tariff, and, you know, all that stuff's been covered over and over and over. Well, I started looking into other things like, you know, what other things have we been told by the government that are not real? If we know that that December 7th, 1941 was a hoax on the American people, not that people didn't die horribly. People did die. You know, brave soldiers, airmen, Marines died so that the president could have an excuse to attack a country that that he had forced their hand and he had forced to attack us. And then that gave him the excuse to go into the other war. Well, and then you start saying, well, then it was a good thing. Ends justifies the means. Well, do you believe that? Then robbing a bank is a good thing, because for you, if you get away with it, the ends justifies the means. So no, the ends doesn't justify the means in one situation and not justify it in the other. And then you go back and you start to say, well, why was Hitler in power in Germany? And so, like, as a teenager, I read Mein Kampf because I wanted to know what the other side of this issue, not because I like Hitler, he was a monster just like the rest of them, but why is Hitler demonized and hated for killing, you know, probably about 6 million Jews and probably a couple million more other ethnic groups, gypsies and some Christians and so forth? Why is he demonized for that, and Stalin's given a pass for killing you know, multiples of that same number? Mao is given a pass for killing multiples of that same number, but Hitler's the bad guy, and it was okay that we propped up Stalin's government for years and years. And so how does that make sense? And then you go back and you say, well, how did Hitler get in power? How did Stalin get in power? World War I basically laid the power into their hands. Why were we in World War I? How is it that we did this? Not we. I wasn't there, but I'm totally innocent of World War I. I promise. I'm not that old, really.
Yeah.
But you get the point, you know. And so then you start looking at the origin of World War I, and then you start seeing things like the Boer Wars. Well, why were the Boer Wars even happening? Why was this going on? Diamonds. Aha. Now, who was taught in high school? Were you ever taught about the Boer Wars in high school?
No. No.
Yeah. Were you ever taught about how the queen at the time, Victoria, was obsessed with diamonds? Who knew? Is it worth, you know, killing the the English had two different enemies. They had the natives, the Zulu people. Zulu people? I believe so, Zulu. Anyway, and they had the Boers, the Dutch. Dutch settlers that had been in South Africa for a couple generations. And everything was fine until gold and diamonds were discovered. And then all of a sudden, the British Crown remembers, you know what? I think we own South Africa. Turns out, we gave it to ourselves. So we just have to go take it, you know? So this was the animosity between Germany and England. It had nothing to do with the Archduke Ferdinand being assassinated. Well, technically, I mean, that was, you know, one pea bouncing around in a world of oppression. But really, this was about you guys irritated the Queen because of the Boer Wars. And, you know, and so now we're going to struggle. Which of these sides is going to end up being the power in the next century? And the United States just went, you know what, I'm going to let you two powers fight it out until you're so weak you can't do anything and you're totally dependent on us. And then the United States is going to come in and we'll be the power. We'll take the ring. we'll go, we'll hold on to the Ring of Power, and we'll go, and we'll take over Mordor, and it'll be ours. And that's exactly what those people did in the early 1900s. They took the Ring of Power out of the hands of the European monarchs, crushed empires that had been around. The Ottomans had been around for 500 years, keeping nasty but relative peace in the Middle East, you know, peace as far as like Rome had held peace. You'll be peaceful or we'll kill you,
right.
You know. But as you start to look at these things and you start to step outside of the narrative and you start to become skeptical of all the things you were taught, you know, I'm a theist, but there are a lot of atheists in the liberty movement, and I appreciate them because that's based on healthy skepticism. And if you have healthy skepticism, then when somebody tells you, you know, oh, you have to believe this religious idea like this and like this, your first thought is why? Why do I have to believe that? Well, you have to believe that there's a creator that made you. Why? Why do I have to believe that? Well, the same thing with historical skepticism. If they say, well, you know, George Washington is the father of our country. Why? What did he do? Was he such a great military leader? And then you start going back and actually looking at the battles that George Washington really actually fought in. And he was a horrible military leader. I mean, he was just terrible. He knew how to retreat really, really good. He had one major victory that he didn't want to do, and this was crossing the Delaware in the middle of the night and attacking people who were asleep. He did that pretty good, but he hated the fact that he did it. It was he didn't like that type of warfare. He liked Napoleonic. It wasn't invented yet, but he liked Napoleonic warfare, where we all line up in lines, we march towards each other, and we shoot until somebody is all gone and somebody is left alive. That's what he liked, and that's what he brought Baron von Steuben over from Germany to teach his men how to fight like that. Well, you're not taught that kind of stuff in history. You're taught that he was this great military leader. No, if you have to look at that war and find a great military leader of that style of fighting, then Lafayette would probably be your man. But Lafayette was the same thing. He was just line everybody up, and I've got more people than you, and we can not die as quick as you're dying, and therefore we win. Well, it's a horrible way to do war. You know, you take a guy like Ethan Allen. Ethan Allen's thoughts were, all right, I want to live. I want to live long enough to be free of the British. How's the best way to do that? Stand in front of them and shoot at them? No. You hide behind a tree, and you shoot the officers. And then you steal everything they've got. And then you run away and go home. And then when you have the advantage again, you go back, and you hide behind a tree and you shoot their officers. Now, nobody, I'm not Larkin Rose, and I'm not telling anybody shoot anybody, okay? I like Larkin.
Yeah, yeah.
Larkin's a good people.
Yeah.
But if you're in a war, I mean, look at how Afghanistan kept empires out for thousands of years. You don't, when facing a superior force, you don't fight them on their ground with their methods. You go around behind their back and you shoot their officers. You blow up their, you know, you set bombs on highways. And again, I'm not that kind of an anarchist. I'm just saying, if you're going to fight an enemy, don't fight by their means. And that's exactly what Washington wanted to do in the War of Independence. He wanted, and then when the war was over and the colonies won the war, Washington's desire, his great desire, was to set up a military and a government exactly like in England, except just don't call it king and, you know, call it president instead. And so there was a concentrated effort, and even to the point of where I found a letter Library of Congress. There we go. I found a Washington letter in the Library of Congress that he wrote to Henry Lee. Henry Lee was pretty much an anarchist, not quite. He hadn't thought it through entirely. You know, he was kind of like an anarchist I might have been 5 or 7 years ago,
right,
who hadn't really thought things through, but inside himself he really was. And so Washington writes a letter to Henry Lee and says, essentially, you want people just to leave each other alone and not have a central government and not have a central standing army. And then he kind of puts this veiled threat in there like, I'm going to get in control, and it's going to be done my way, and you're going to accept it, aren't you? I mean, it was like mafia talk. It was the kind of talk that among biker gangs, you know, they speak this way. You don't openly threaten somebody. You say, things could happen, and that would be terrible if this happened. And that's what Washington did to Henry Lee. And so, you know, you see things like this in history, and you have to step back, and you have to use the same skepticism that drives a person to seek the truth and not just accept what's been handed to you on a platter.
Yeah, but Ben, since guns are, I mean, this sounds like so much horrible stuff, and it sounds like guns are the problem, right? So we just need to get rid of all guns and have no guns in the world, right?
Yay.
Well, I mean, what do you say? No, let me ask you a serious question here, though. When people come up to you that are for gun control, when you are maybe on the internet talking to people, and we try to have logical conversations with people, obviously, so, and I assume you've had a couple of these yourself, what do you usually say to people who say, well, we need to have a law for this, or we need to have, it just seems so silly to me how people can't see, you know, like the failed war on drugs and everything else, you know, is wasting $1 trillion, and drugs are almost at the same usage levels as they were in 71 when Nixon started up the war on drugs. Why do people keep running to this system to prohibit things, knowing that it won't work? It just doesn't seem rational to me.
I typically try to step away from the emotion of the particular object involved. You know, the gun. It's scary. It makes a loud noise, and I don't own one, so I do. But I'm saying from their point of view. And I try to take it to property because, you know, the gun has no magical characteristics. It's not, you know, it's not forged in some by elves in some magic cave, you know, deep in, you know, it's just a piece of metal.
Right.
And all it does, its only function is to sling another piece of metal very rapidly. So in that sense, you know, the gun is dangerous. The gun can kill somebody. So can a rock. And rocks killed a lot more people than guns. So really, let's not talk about the gun, let's talk about property. Do I have the right to own property? If I have the right to own property, then I get to choose which property. Now, that property might be a rock, and I might do something evil with that rock. So we have to have a system that we can take care of each other and arrive at a conclusion as to what to do when someone takes a rock and does something bad with it. Well, that process is wrapped up in the zero aggression principle and the ability to self, you know, to protect yourself and the ability to hire someone to protect you or make alliances with people who can protect you. So if we take the gun out and we replace it with a rock or a brick or anything else, then really we're talking about human behavior and we're talking about property rights and we're talking about the zero aggression principle. So it doesn't have to be a gun. What if tomorrow somebody invented you know, a new thing that we don't have a word for because, you know, in 1100 AD, they didn't have the word gun, but they knew what a bow and arrow was. They knew what a spear was, and a blade would kill you just as quick as a gun today. So if we take away the magic of the gun and we just look at it as property and as aggression and as self-defense, then it boils down to you know, even using the word rights to say property rights, it gets a little fuzzy because systematically those who control government have washed out the meaning of many words like anarchy and property and rights. So I think it's better to be able to, and I believe that we should stand up for certain words and say, no, anarchy is not violence. Anarchy is not, you know, out of control, crazy. It's not any of those things. This is what anarchy is. But the same thing with property and the same thing with rights. But if we can get them to see those things by using other things that are not scary. So we talk about, you know, the rock, or we talk about a knife, or we talk about something that's, you know, I think it was Archie Bunker when his daughter was complaining about the dangers of guns and how many people were killed by guns, he said, would you feel better if they was pushed out of windows? And I mean, really, it comes down to that, because it's the aggression that causes the harm, not the inanimate object. The object is beside the point. And so if we hold people responsible for their actions, And then somebody can say, well, that's what we have government for. Government provides justice for us. The problem with that is that government has never been able to provide justice. It's not, let's say if person A, John shoots Bill. And we have magic people that we call police that can figure out that John shot Bill, killed Bill. Doesn't matter how he killed him. He killed him. Bill's dead. Okay. So what's the government's solution to this situation? How can they provide justice? Well, the government's going to go out and they're going to rob from 5,000 other people, and they're going to take the money from that robbery, and they're going to investigate this horrible incident. And if they find out that they have enough evidence to put this guy in jail or give him, you know, capital punishment for this murder, then they'll put him in jail and they'll continue to rob this other 5,000 people or 500,000 people or 5 million people. They'll continue to rob them to keep him alive and healthy and well until they come to the conclusion that they've kept him alive long enough and now they're going to kill him. And then they're going to rob all these people to have enough money to kill him with. And then they're going to call that justice. Now, in the meantime, dead Bill, his family is without Bill. His family is without the income that Bill would have brought in. The government doesn't care. They've found what they call justice. Well, that's not justice. The government hasn't prevented the death, and the government hasn't done any actual action to produce real justice. It's punished this guy to a certain extent, but is that all justice is? If justice is just punishing him, then eventually the logical end of that is to just let a mob beat him. And that's kind of where we're going with police anyway. When the police decide that this person is a bad person, it's beatdown time. That's the inevitable of the process that we've begun hundreds of years ago when we accepted having police. So the state, the government can't produce justice. They can only produce more violence, more robbery, more killing. So what are we left with? We have to take this back down to the zero aggression principle and not allow ourselves to be wrapped up in what the object is or how scary the object is or what the name of the object is, and go back with what behavior are we dealing with and how can we bring, how can we control other people's behavior through market processes and not through the aggression of a top-down government, a centrally planned government.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like you were saying at the beginning of the show, actually, keep aiming for that target, right? If you aren't aiming for that target, you're wasting your time. I completely agree with you. Listen, we ran out of time. I want to give – I always give everybody a chance to give plugs, websites, articles, videos, links. Obviously, badquaker.com, but – whatever else you want to have people see or go check out, go ahead and list that as well as a closing statement. So make sure you give a little closing statement for – you know, what I usually say to people is you're going to have – you're on your deathbed and all the news stations, you know, come up to you with the microphone. You got a 1 or 2 minutes soundbite. What do you want people to hear before we head out today?
Well, let's go to the shout-out first.
Okay.
And happy birthday to Nima Vidadia, the Freedom Fiends. And he and my friend Michael W. Dean do the Freedom Fiends over there, and today is Nima's birthday. So happy birthday, Nima. And I want to say that, you know, what I was talking about money to Ron Paul, if you got money and you don't know what to do with it, don't send it to a politician, any politician. Pick out somebody like the Free State Project or, you know, Larkin Rose or Michael Shanklin or the Freedom Fiends or, you know, anything like that. Find the flavor that fits you, but don't give your money to a politician. And, you know, if I could sum up what I would like to be maybe remembered as or remembered about, I would think it very much like Murray Rothbard, that I'm an enemy of the state. Deep inside, I hate the state. It's a deep, boiling hatred. I'm not a militant against the state. I will never, ever take up arms against the state. I will do everything I can to allow the state to reach its climax and its logical end and collapse. Because if we just leave it alone, step away from it, keep ourselves safe from it, it will kill itself. It will eventually cycle through and kill itself. and we win. And that's how we do it. We just step away and let the logical processes of aggression, and the state will eat itself. So I want to be remembered as an enemy of the state, but not a combatant of the state. I'll let the state do its own fighting.
Beautiful.
I'll stay behind the tree.
Beautiful. I completely agree. So I want to actually make a video just on that. That's how much I agree with that statement, because, you know, obviously we are against people using violence on other peaceful people. But we obviously don't believe that more violence is going to solve the problem of aggressive violence. So I completely agree with you, Ben. Hopefully I can have you back on within the next month or two. How's that sound?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. You're an amazing guest, and hopefully I see your name in other TV shows and radio shows and podcasts in the future. So make sure you guys go check out badquaker.com. I'll talk to you soon, Ben.
Thanks a lot,
Thank
Michael.
Thank you guys for checking out Triple V. As you guys know, you can always find the show every single day. We also have a ton of great guests coming up here in the next month. So if you guys want to check out the schedule, head over to voluntaryvirtues.com, and it's not hard to see the schedule. You guys can't miss it. If you guys ever have any questions, please email me at shanklinmike@yahoo.com. I try to respond as quickly as possible. You can also message me over on YouTube with my username Mike Shanklin, or on LiveLeak, which is Shanklin Mike. So a little flip-flop there, but Shanklin Mike on LiveLeak, and then Mike Shanklin over on YouTube. Plus, you can always find me over on Statism is Slavery on Facebook, or on my Facebook page, Individual Freedom for All. So that is one of my newest projects I've started, and I think that one's going to be pushing. I think we're about to hit 1,000 people. I haven't done too much work over there, but I think it's going to be growing. So we'll see where that goes. But as you know, I will see you guys tomorrow. Thank you so much for checking out Triple V. I'll see you soon. Bye.
Well, that was Michael's show. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure and get over and follow the links in today's show notes at badquaker.com. And visit Mike Shanklin's YouTube webpage and visit Voluntary Virtues. And as always, remember to get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks. Bye.